All right. Hello, everybody. It is our CFB Talk 28. We are on and we are getting this launched. Just sent out the tweet. I know my co-host JD will be here any moment. There he is. So we've had another busy, well, somewhat busy, well, mundane off-season week, but we're here to talk college football with all of you, as we like to do on Tuesday night. So again, my name is Bob Akairi. JD, you're here. You're my co-host. What's going on?
Well, hello there, everybody. Big day in my personal life. So today is my Mimi's 86th birthday today. And this is the nice little reminder to all of y'all. If you've got living grandparents and a good relationship, give them a call, give them a visit. It's always a wonderful time to hear from your older generations and really cherish the time that you've got on earth with them. Always really recommend it. It's a beautiful time to do that, and it's a beautiful time to, talk about college football in the off season as well. We've got a couple of things that are going to be coming up in the next couple of weeks here with Reddit CFB. We have a very exciting guest coming on next week that I can't wait to do a little bit of interviewing with to talk about the NFL draft of all things. So it's an exciting time for us. And Bobak, what are some of the headlines that you've been seeing recently?
Well, there's been a mix of interesting topics this week. I mean, I was trying to look at them almost thematically. I mean, one of the more big topics, and it kind of echoes what we discussed last week, because last week we were talking about Dabo talking about the state of college football and whether or not the system as it was needs to be torn down and replaced. Well, 6 days ago, or at least a week ago, basically not long after our last show, Nick Saban basically echoed the same sentiment that the current state of NCAA football is not sustainable. I think this has been an ongoing question, particularly with how the NIL deals have changed the state of the sport a bit. I know there was sort of a humorous, snarky conversation, basically saying, remember when people said NIL wouldn't make the playing field more even, in sort of a sarcastic manner, and a lot of people had sort of conversations about when amateurism in NCAA football left, or if it has left, or if it ever existed. Some were joking that, amateurism went away when Pudge Heffelfinger met with the Yale alumni in 1888 and suddenly decided not to go to Minnesota. I don't know if that's even a real thing. And my favorite response to that is early football history could be made up or true, and you would not know the difference. But, couple of other highlights that I thought were interesting was, I mean, this one isn't a big story. It's more of like it's fascinating to see players who constantly move. But JT Daniels is now headed to West Virginia, which sets up the possibility of JT Daniels playing Slovis in the backyard brawl, just like everyone
Oh,
predicted 2 years ago.
oh, yes.
So. Yeah, there's a, how about you, JD? What are some of the headlines that got your attention this week?
I mean, this one isn't necessarily a headline, but earlier today, I absolutely loved the graphic that SMU posted out of them just completely leaning in and embracing finally the Trans Am. And especially with Eric Dickerson quote tweeting it a little bit earlier today. I know that we also quote tweeted it on Reddit CFB, but I absolutely love the fact that SMU had just decided to lean all in on this imagery and embrace, who the Pony Express was and try to bring it in as they're going under a new regime under Rhett Lashley, trying to build up what Sonny Dykes had previously built up, keep the momentum going. I thoroughly, absolutely enjoyed that. I mean, you know me, I love my Texas football history. I love my Southwest Conference history. And the fact that SMU just decided, you know what, go Trans Am, middle of this graphic, show with the other coaches that we've got here, all roads go to Dallas. I absolutely loved seeing that earlier today.
Yeah, the top response to that on Reddit CFB was the Southwest Conference will live on in our hearts forever. Hey, Jawan, you joined us. What's going on? How are you this evening?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Huh? Good. What's on your mind in the college football universe?
Oh man, I'm just keeping a watch on recruiting right now because we're in the off season. I don't like to use the word off season. Shout out to late kick Josh, but we're in the waiting season, waiting on the season to start. So I'm just seeing what dominoes really fall in recruiting right now, and seeing what players are going to hit the transfer portal, see what other moves that they're making in the coaching world, offensive coordinators, defensive coordinators, just seeing how the season's going. I've been watching a lot of spring game film also, trying to decide who are my early favorites, who could be a surprise team this year. Right now, I'm really liking the Utah Utes. I feel like they had an underrated offense, but there's been a lot of headlines going on about NIL, man. Like you guys are saying, that they're using it more as a recruiting tool. But I feel like that's a crutch that a lot of coaches are using, saying, hey, we can't beat these guys out. They got more money than us, which isn't true. As we've seen whenever Caleb Williams jumped into the transfer portal, even Eastern Washington threw a bone out trying to get him. So I don't really think that it's NIL per se that's taking over recruiting. Because if anything, I'm seeing guys go a little bit of everywhere. Right now, if I'm not mistaken, Texas Tech has the number one recruiting class right now. Just because they have over 14 guys committed right now. I think they have an average composite of 86. But I just think it's just different days and times is why recruiting's changing now.
Oh, you're absolutely right on that. I mean, one of the huge things of everybody who was saying like, oh, NIL is going to corrupt the game. It's going to change everything. Listen, we just spent a couple of minutes talking about a gold Trans Am and why SMU is embracing that ideology again. This has always been stuff that's always been in the background of college football. And the difference with NIL is a lot of it gets to be just a little bit out in the open. There was a really fascinating article out from Stuart Mandel, I believe it was, noting some of the deals that have recently been signed of, you know, a couple guys doing a 4-year deal for $1 million, defensive linemen getting a cut of the action, I think for like $250,000 or something else like that. And it's really, these are people who are spending money in these collectives where you now have to have a collective if you're a college football program because you need to be able to compete with everybody. But it's a thing of they're spending money on a team that's not necessarily a complete known entity. It's always going to be you're still at the end of the day gambling on 17 and 18 year olds being worth your time and worth your money, which, again, if you are 17, 18 years old, you can pull down $1 million just for being a college football athlete. Absolutely more power to you. And I love seeing that for them. But I think you're definitely right where I don't think a change in recruiting is necessarily because of NIL. It is just because of the time that we have now. You have to recruit the transfer portal. You have to make sure that you have a name, image, likeness strategy for your players coming in so that they know how to maximize their opportunity, not even necessarily while they're in college, but what they're going to do after college. Bobak, I mean, I know you, of all people, have been watching college football for quite a while, and you've seen kind of the changes in eras that's happened with college football. What's your take on that?
I don't know if I'm offended. I'm not that old. I'm in my 40s for heaven's sake. But you know, what I do think of when we get into these conversations is, was the portal the bigger impact? I mean, NIL deals are nice, and they certainly entice players to move, but I think without the portal streamlining the transfer process, which used to be onerous and sometimes just completely asinine in its results, the transfer portal made it easier to move. And then the NIL deals are how people are kind of reaching in to try and get those players that they really desire, I think, out there. So I would say that was the bigger change. I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe I could be swayed otherwise. And by the way, again, just to emphasize, we love hearing from the rest of you out there. If you want to come up here and talk with us, just hit request and we'll let you up and we'll talk about whatever college football topic you want. But going back to this, I mean, I do agree with the fact that college football was never about parity. Amateurism was somewhere in between. I mean, college football predates the NCAA, and the NCAA, of course, was something designed to sort of buy university presidents to kind of take care of what they were interested in. But I mean, you know, the reason, for example, the reason, as some of you may know, the NCAA never ran the college football playoff like it did basketball to some of these other sports is the bowl system predates the NCAA. So it was already an established entity before there was any way to regulate it. Now, there's so many, history's littered with instances of the haves getting offending the have-nots, and it's just an area where parity is been impossible to establish. I mean, you know, the Pac-12 famously, they were, I forgot it, what their original, they had a previous name, and it ended because of so much controversy over USC, UCLA, and I believe Washington were paying their players just very overtly, and it caused the collapse of the predecessor of what became the Pac-8, which basically, again, became the same teams again once everyone was let back in, which is now the Pac-12. So, I mean, this isn't just the Southwest Conference or an SEC thing. It's been all over the place. And even with the FCS programs, specifically the non-scholarship ones, the ones that can only give academic scholarships, I remember right before they dropped football, not that long ago, I think it was within the last 10 years, Jacksonville, not Jacksonville State, but the Jacksonville, which is a private school in Jacksonville, Florida, they got in trouble with their conference because they were getting a little too blurry on their non-athletic scholarships, so that they got penalized there. So this has been going on at every level, even, you know, areas where there is absolutely no financial benefit to the football program, like a non-scholarship FCS program. But hey, I see we have someone requesting. I'm going to go ahead and let you up. Jason, we'd love to hear from you. Feel free to unmute.
Oh, I don't know why it does that to me every time. It's like my phone glitches. Yeah, man, thanks for having me again. I think you make a good point about, you know, it predating the NCAA and all of that. Something I've been thinking about this week that I guess doesn't really get talked about much is, like, we've seen so much change to college football over the last few years. And, I mean, you could attribute it to a number of things, whether it be TV contracts or – you know, a lot of crying about the playoff system and, you know, people, like you said, wanting parity. But I don't think that's really the thing because, you know, to your point, like you want parity in college football. For example, people want a bigger playoff system. Well, the FCS has a legit playoff system and North Dakota State's won 9 out of the last 11 championships. So I don't think it's really going to change much, you know.
No, like, that's the thing. So, one of the great things about college football is we love the idea of the upset. We love the idea of chaos. But when you look at the history of college football, it is so overwhelmingly top heavy throughout the entire history of the sport. Like, I know everybody likes to complain, oh, Alabama's in the playoff all the time. Or, oh, we see Clemson just dominating the ACC all the time. You know, if you look back into the history books, Florida State won the ACC every single year between 1992 and, with one exception, all the way through, I believe it was 2003 in the ACC. From 1969 until essentially the dissolution of the Big Eight, either Oklahoma or Nebraska won it every single year, with the exception of Colorado's run in, I believe it was 89 and 1990. If you look out in the Pac-12, or what was the Pac-10, it was USC, UCLA, and Washington taking almost every single title over the course of 30 years, with the exception of Arizona State taking it in 1986. And this is a continued pattern for a long, long time in every conference. We've seen runs of national championships, no matter the format, no matter the recruiting cycle. It's always been a very top-heavy sport, but I think one of the reasons that we all end up loving that top-heaviness and we like to talk about parity is the idea that at any time you could see an Appalachian State topple a number 5 Michigan. You could see a wild and crazy run this past season we just had Washington State nearly make the Rose Bowl. If it had just come down to, you know, we had one final game where Oregon State beats Oregon, we would have had, what, a 7-5 coachless Washington State team playing in the Pac-12 championship for an opportunity for the Rose Bowl. That's what we love about college football. It's not necessarily we can crown any type of champion. We haven't had a brand new champion since Florida in 96, but we love it because anybody can fall at any moment.
I agree with you on that. We love college football because anybody can fall at any moment. And I feel like those, the original powers, those guys that you just named, how many of those teams are major players right now? And that's what I'm loving about college football is the transition, the emergence of new players. We haven't had a new champion in a while, but it's been a while since Georgia has won one, over 40 years, if I'm not mistaken, is what they said. So I'm counting that technically as new blood, really, in this new playoff era that we're in. We had two teams this year that had never been in a playoff before make it, with Michigan and Cincinnati.
Yes, so it really has me.
I'm excited, man. I just feel like football is at a 2007 season type of like vibe where anyone, any year, whoever wants to take the reins, I don't think there's a clear cut head and shoulders team that's better than everybody. As good as the top teams are, Alabama, Ohio State, so forth. You can still see a team come in and knock those guys off. JD, I know you're a Texas A&M guy. They didn't consider A&M. Last year wasn't as good of a season for A&M, but look what they did against the Tide last year.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, we got to issue a quick correction out here. So I am a big Texas as a state football fan, first and foremost. My alma mater is TCU. I'm currently doing my grad schooling at Texas State. So I can't claim any kind of allegiance to Texas A&M other than enjoying the state of Texas football. So let's get that on the record right there.
Hey, well, okay, I mean, sorry about that. How'd you feel when SMU planted that flag, man?
You good.
The funny thing is, Giggum is referenced to TCU. Isn't it? I mean, the Giggum hand gesture that Texas A&M fans make is actually a reference to their rivalry against TCU.
Yes, that is correct. So way back in the day, back in the 1930s, Southwest Conference becoming a big thing. You got to remember, you got championships at TCU in 35 and 38. Texas A&M wins their championship in 1939. You've got a really strong in-state rivalry going. So when they do Giggum, that's when they've got the thumbs up. Everybody knows a thumbs up at Texas A&M, but it's not necessarily a thumbs up like, hey, good job, or hey, hello, or something else like that. It is originally for gigging a frog and essentially using what looks like a little spear or a trident, calling a gig. And so when they say gig'em and they use the thumbs up, it's not necessarily as a, you know, like a greeting or a good job, but it's literally to indicate taking a gig and literally gigging a frog to try to kill it.
So anyway, Giggum, JD. Hey, by the way, Adam, I noticed we let you up. I'd love to hear from you. It's been a while.
Yes. No, thank you for having me on. Thank you for putting this on. You know, obviously, JD just went on a hell of a history lesson there with college football in the great state of Texas. I wanted to talk about, you know, we talk about the advancement of NIL and everything else, you know. Think back to the BCS days where, you know, teams had to have that strength of schedule. Imagine now if the BCS was still a thing. Obviously, as a West Coast guy myself, I think the West Coast bias is a firm issue in college sports, kind of in all sports, but primarily in football. You would see probably, you know, half the SEC in the top 25, in my opinion. But just imagine back, you know, I remember growing up watching, of course, Texas, USC, Ohio State, those guys that have always kind of been around. But now look at how things have changed with, you know, the landscape of the South, the Southeastern Conference. You know, a lot of Texas, obviously you have Oklahoma, you know, and JD just said it, you know, with Nebraska and Oklahoma, you know, they were still powerhouses, but you know, some schools fall off and some schools have risen up. But you know, I think how things have changed, the original issue of, well, how do we make it to the national championship, you know, it was still a select few and you had to be in that top two. And you know, I remember when Auburn got you know, misplaced or not allowed to be in the BCS, and they had not lost a game. So I think we talk about, you know, how do college sports advance and how, and really just comes back to who has the opportunity to win a national championship. And those teams that have done well and have been able to elevate themselves, you know, as a university, but primarily as a athletic program, they've always been ahead of the game, or they've been able to take advantage of things. And I think, you know, we just look at these systems of how schools that, you know, obviously love what Coastal Carolina's done, some other teams, App State stepping up. You know, we love the madness of the upset in the season, but whenever it comes to playoff time, we want to see our team be successful. And so those teams that have done that have continually been able to grow with the times of, you know, whatever it might be, NIL, all those things that we have going now. I think it's going to be interesting the next couple years with conference realignment and everything else. More competition is always good, I think.
I agree with you, but I don't think there's really a West Coast bias, because if you look at what happened with Oregon this year, okay, Oregon goes into the horseshoe first game and knocks off Ohio State. That was really the only quality win that they had this year. When they had a chance to get two other quality wins, which would have been beating Utah twice, which they got destroyed both times, that really disqualified them. And then they lost to a really, really bad Stanford team. But even after that Stanford loss, the committee never bumped them out of the number four spot until they lost to Utah. But I'm just your casual football fan as myself. I watch everybody. But I think if a Pac-12 team would separate themselves and just go undefeated and win their conference championship, there really wouldn't be a bias. They would definitely put them in the playoff. We're looking, as a college football fans, we're looking for any reason to stick the Pac-12 in there, man. I think Washington was the last team to get in from the Pac-12. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I was going to say this earlier about NIL. I think they should have a rule or a law or something. They need to give back all the scholarships and death penalties that has occurred over the years, even going back to the Trans Am with Eric Dickerson.
That would be an interesting one. That would be, I think the only complication there is how do we even quantify that. But I can imagine a lot of fan bases would love that, to see that returned in some way. But I mean, you do play the rules at the time you're playing. So I suppose the counter argument would be, for example, not to get too into the weeds and legalese from my own background, but you know, sometimes when the laws are changed, they're usually prospective. It's like either starting with the case that changed the law, or and in some unfortunate cases, somebody will cause the court to change a law, but it will be starting after the case that they brought to the court. I've seen that too. So I could see that being the counter argument, but I'm not going to give that. Yeah, speaking of NIL, on a lighter note, one of my favorite stories this week, and the headline was so weird, like they had no punctuation, but there was a guy arrested in a stolen car for speeding. And this sports car was traced to a car dealership, which claimed that it was actually tied to an NIL deal with an LSU football player. So that's a mouthful. So basically, yeah, there was a guy in a 2018 Dodge Challenger who was pulled over last week. He didn't own the car, and then they found out it was technically belonged to a dealership. But then the dealer said the car was loaned to the LSU player back in August of last year. But it was reported stolen a few weeks back when the dealer said it was never returned by the player who got the car. So I don't know. That one was probably one of my favorite NIL related stories this week. Certainly it's on the lighter side, and this is something that, you know, we wouldn't have never expected to hear several years ago as a possible story that, you know, is more of amusement rather than how did the player ever get the car to begin with. Jason, I know you wanted to join again. I think you accidentally got dropped from the conversation. Did you want to add anything? And by the way, if anyone else would like to join our conversation, just hit request. We'd love to let you up.
Yeah, I had to drop out. I had to take a phone call there. No, something I'll touch on that you were just mentioning, you know, talking about these NIL deals. Something, and I'm actually going to have a conversation with you know, NIL consultant here in a few weeks on my podcast, which I'm not promoting here or anything like that. But so, I mean, it's kind of funny because everyone knows. It's like everyone knows that basically now these NIL collectives that are school specific are effectively just buying players. Everyone knows it. And it's kind of like just the giant fucking elephant in the room that who's going to do anything about it? We don't know. I mean, tampering is going on everywhere. I mean, it's well known that tampering is just a nightmare in college football right now. And it's a giant elephant in the room, and no one knows who's going to, like, step up and enforce the rules. The NCAA is scared to death to do anything about it because they don't want to get ramrodded in court again by the Supreme Court. So, I mean, I think that's where they kind of were going, like Saban and Dabo, with the whole this is not sustainable, because it is going to lead to just a giant arms race of who's going to buy the best players. You know, I mean, what are we going to – Ohio State sponsored by Amazon.com? I mean, what, like, it's out of control, man. I don't know where it's headed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the big concern that we see even from someone who could theoretically get any resources he would ever want with – Nick Saban, and it was something that was even echoed by Lane Kiffin and, of course, Dabo on the state of where college football is heading. So I could see there being restrictions, but it's going to be foisted by top programs, perhaps those that can pull a little bit of, you know, heft within their conferences. Maybe we'll see it on the conference level first, which will allow in that window for the NCAA to kind of step in. I'm sure the SEC coming up with some restrictions would still be looser than anything obviously the NCAA might want to do. And that could still be what we see as the results for some kind of restriction on the NIL, you know, on the NIL sort of Wild West we're in now. You know, speaking of SEC teams and speaking of speeding, you know, I just wanted to bring up another story that came up that I thought was – well, the Fulmer Cup, which we ran for a couple of years, has somewhat fallen into a sway. It sort of lost its luster during the pandemic, so we haven't really been keeping that up. But Florida Gators QB Anthony Richardson was cited for speeding 105 miles an hour, and not on the freeway. That SEC speed – was on Newbury Road, which is about 10 minutes west of Ben Hill Griffith Stadium, the Swamp in Gainesville. So I'm not sure what he was thinking, but at least the car was his and not a car from a dealership that had been loaned as an NIL deal to an LSU player. Speaking of Florida, Billy Napier says they will be wearing black jerseys, hopefully not in a daytime game in the Swamp, but that is something else to look out for the Gators fans out there. I think that's going to be interesting. I mean, you know, it's always fun to see them try different uniforms. I'm not sure if black is necessarily my favorite on Florida, but I'll let the rest of you decide that on whether you find that interesting or not. JD.
Listen, it cannot be worse than those tire track ones, right? I mean, you look at the different options that Florida's had over the years. They've had a couple of great, fantastic, classic looks. I think everybody loves that all white with the Gator script on the helmet. But I just cannot help but think about what is the appropriate time for Florida to wear black, and how are they going to mess it up by putting it out like in the middle of September?
I think Florida, and this is coming from an Alabama fan, I think Florida has it's easily top five, you know, just their uniform in general, the colors, the script, everything. It's easily one of the top five uniforms in college football. And I mean, I guess maybe that's kind of a Napier's trying to sort of change things up, put his mark on the program, whatever you want to call it. But I kind of look at that like, if, you know, don't be like Oregon, man. Like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, man. I mean, there's like Georgia hasn't changed their uniforms outside of wearing, you know, maybe one alternate and the black jerseys in the last 40 years. And I don't think it's really a problem.
I tend to lean that way, too. I mean, part of the reason, and I wonder if it's just bias, because for me, I went to the University of Southern California. they're known for not putting names on the back of the jerseys. They're known for basically keeping the same style, more or less, with just slight differences in the way they put the hoops on the sleeves for the last however many, 50 years. But, that's, I think, why some people like the Penn State uniform. Obviously, the classic Alabama uniform with the numbers on the helmets, the classic Texas uniform. I think perhaps, I don't know how much of that is just sort of what people associate the traditions with the blue blood programs. I kind of get what Oregon was doing because I still remember when they went off the deep end that year. I think the first game was at Mississippi State when they really went into just completely wild uniforms, to the point where I remember I couldn't tell if my TV needed to be adjusted because my TV was glowing because that was back when they were CRTs, the boxes. And famously, I don't know if people know this, because that was a year they debuted the lightning yellow, which was the really wild neon yellow on Oregon jerseys. They played them for the first time. They opened the season at Mississippi State, and then those jerseys never appeared again, despite the fact that they were still rotating through new jerseys. And some people thought, oh, they didn't like them. What happened was the equipment manager just threw them in the wash and didn't pay attention to Nike's very specific washing instructions, did what he did with every jersey he'd ever washed before, threw it in the washer on high heat, and it caused the color to leave all of the jerseys because they had to be washed on a slightly cooler temperature. And that was the way the lightning yellows, the first round, none of them exist anymore because he wiped them all out in that one washing incident. So that's one of those things people don't necessarily – that's still one of my favorite stories in college football uniform. Because, I mean, first of all, if you've never had a chance to visit the guys in the equipment room, it's always some of the funnest people in, I think, any college football program because they're like jacks of all trades. We all remember that – I can't remember what game it was where there was a guy with a sewing machine repairing jerseys on the side of the game. It's just – it's one of those things where the folks in that office are always the jacks of all trades and sort of the – engineers keeping the team running during every game. I remember I got to sit down with a lot of the folks at the Tulane equipment room. First of all, just the sheer number of – I never realized exactly how – you always see that at the All-Star games where they'll trade helmet stickers from all of the different teams and all the different logos. So you'll see helmets that look like just completely, covered in various team logos. But a lot of programs do that. And then you walk into the equipment room, you look up, and it's just like every logo you've ever seen is just stuck up there because they just bring extras and trade them. I think it's absolutely awesome. Jason, you wanted to add something.
Oh, I didn't even realize I was unmuted. Well, I will add to that. My fault. But I will add to that something you mentioned. We should all send that send that Oregon equipment manager a thank you letter because those uniforms were god awful. But aside from that, you being a USC guy, I know you'll appreciate this. Something I wish more that we saw more of was like when you see the UCLA versus USC and they wear the red and the blue. I wish a lot more teams did that. Like I would love to see an Alabama and Auburn game where you saw the crimson on one side and the navy blue jerseys on the other. Like, I think that's awesome. And I don't really understand why no one else does it, really. I mean, you might see it occasionally, but it's pretty rare.
Oh, absolutely. And, this is something I think USC and UCLA fans are somewhat proud of here because famously, they historically would do that where both teams would wear their home colors because one is red, one is blue. It's easy to tell them apart. And then for the longest time, the rule was changed, I believe, at the NCAA level and to basically please television. Because in the black and white TV days, it just was easier to see the teams, the contrast on the television screen. So that is where that rule came from. Now, and I'm trying to remember what exact year it was. I believe it was 2009 or 2008. But the teams agreed when it was – because Rick Neuheisel was – yeah, it was 2008. Rick Neuheisel was the coach of UCLA. He had played there himself. Pete Carroll was at USC. They agreed with each other, gentlemen's agreement, let's both play in our home colors, and we will just eat the penalties that are going to be in that are going to happen. And this game happened at the Rose Bowl. So technically that hit penalty hit USC at the beginning of the very first play of the first half. I was at that game. The very first play of the first half, they called a penalty on USC for wearing the wrong jerseys. And then UCLA immediately called a timeout. Because, I mean, I should say this. The penalty gave USC, had forced them to burn a timeout. So UCLA also burned a timeout. So they, and I remember to the cheers of the crowd, the referee said the timeouts will run concurrently. And that was how, until they finally changed the rule at the end of the year, those two teams were able to finally return playing to home and home colors. And there are a couple of other programs that have done that. I know BYU and Utah, which again, you have a blue and a red contrast, have done that as well in some of their games. I know quite infamously, at least one of the, I forgot who the UCLA coach was, decided for one game to just go back to not letting, going not back to home and home colors, but it's since come back again. But I'd love to see that. I'd love to see Alabama and Auburn do that. I think, you know, Texas and Oklahoma, have they done that? I don't know if Texas and Oklahoma have tried the home and home again there. But there are plenty of options there for that to work.
Someone that needs to do it, I think there should be an exhibition game every year where Nebraska and Wisconsin should both have to wear their home jerseys and just try and figure out who they're throwing to. I think that'd be it'd be a lot of fun to watch anyway.
Absolutely. JD, who do you think you'd like? Who would you like to see? What teams do you think would be good as a home and home matchup?
For like a full color scheme, essentially?
Yeah, for full color.
You know, I think the only thing that could have made the game better this year when they were playing it in the snow, put a scarlet and gray up against that maize and blue in the snow. I want to see Ohio State and Michigan playing in full colors every single year. Hands down, no question.
Ooh, that's a good one. Hey, Adam, Juwan, do you guys have ideas on this?
I'd like to see Florida versus Florida State. Those are the garnet and gold. I've always loved that color scheme.
That is one of the classiest, I think, combinations in college football. The way that looks on Florida State is unmistakable. Before I even really even cared about college football and I just happened to turn on the TV looking for Saturday morning cartoons and seeing football preempting it, I was like, oh, that looks neat. Oh, what are those cool things on their helmet? You know what I mean? Those are some of my earliest memories. Adam.
Yes, this is going to be probably a surprise, I think, but I think we can go ACC. Let's get a Syracuse in some orange or blue, all right, and a Miami in green or orange if we want some chaos.
Yeah, I was about to say, or Clemson. Let's get two teams in orange, just all orange. Good luck for that. And then have everyone looking at each other really angry about which the uniforms the other team picked. JD.
Let's see. If I'm going to draft a second famous rivalry in order to put in for an all-color matchup, I think still hands down Ohio State and Michigan is going to be the top one on there, but immediate second billing. This game's going to be coming back in the next couple of years. I'm going to be kind of furious if we don't have Texas A&M and Texas up in maroon and burnt orange.
Oh, gosh. I can't. I mean, I think that is going to be one of the most hotly anticipated games in the new SEC when that's all geared up. You know, one of the other, speaking of, I mean, we're talking about USC and Ohio State, sort of a clunky transition here. One of the more popular posts today on our CFB was USC kicker Parker Lewis, which, again, I'm sorry. This is, all right, now I'm going to sound old. When I read that, I'm like, all I can do is finish that with Parker Lewis can't lose. But anyway, he said Ohio State had more fans in the stadium during the spring game than any USC home game I played my freshman and sophomore year, which makes sense. I believe Ohio State had, what was it, 60,000 for their spring game? It was a pretty hefty number. I know some schools can get more. And I think that is the nature of USC football. And one of those things that Mr. Lincoln Riley has stepped into there. And I'm not going to say, you know, it's interesting to see how people react to it, because some people are immediately jumping on the pro teams like, oh, well, you know, Los Angeles has the Lakers. They have the Rams, you know, they have, which was hilarious because, again, Los Angeles hasn't had a pro football team for like 20 years. So, I mean, all those years in between, USC football, unless you were coached by Pete Carroll, wasn't pulling in the numbers, and neither has UCLA. It's just the nature of LA sports and maybe Southern California sports in general. It's just hard to get people interested, which is a shame because, I mean, the LA metropolitan area, depending on how you draw it, is 14 million to 17 million people, which is more people than the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama combined. So the reality is, though, it's just the mentality of the place. I grew up in the region. I mean, in the armpit of the state. I grew up north in the Central Valley, but I spent time in LA when I went there and lived there. But it's just unfortunate, you know, for a lot of sports. It's unless you're a winner, people just don't care. And I guess, again, I've always said the analog to that is Miami, perhaps to a lesser extent, New York. It's just some of these larger cities. Maybe it is a combination of the people that are attracted to live there, or it is just sort of the nature of the place. But unfortunately, I wasn't surprised at all, especially when you consider the Clay Helton years that preceded the last several seasons. I mean, the only game in the last 2 years that passed the Ohio State spring game in attendance was a rivalry USC hosting UCLA game in the Coliseum. So I don't think that's – I mean, will it change if Lincoln Riley starts winning? Yeah, sure, it'll change in a hurry. If it changes in Westwood, well, technically Pasadena, but if it changes at UCLA for football, yeah, people will start going. But it's just one of those things. And I'm not saying that Columbus is a more boring city and that people have nothing better to do. It's just the culture of it all. I think that's what it boils down to. It's like, I mean, it's not like people are going to the beach in Disneyland every day in the West Coast. It's just one of those things. Adam.
Well, I was listening to you guys. I was also have two things. I wanted to say just one more addition to the alternate jerseys, and this is again for some chaos. Let's see a Miami in all black against Georgia in all black and see who wins that one. But back to what you were talking about, you know, yeah, I remember myself growing up in California and growing up more towards, you know, Sacramento, watching college football. I remember when Cal, USC, UCLA, all those teams that had better players than what they kind of have now, you know, there was a different competition level amongst Pac-10, Pac-12, you know, Big Ten. All the conference differences have kind of changed and shifted. And it's kind of interesting to see, you know, myself as a football coach and seeing people adjust to what it is in the present day. So just interesting to watch and see. And whenever you go back and look at those types of things that you're talking about.
Yeah. And speaking of the Bay Area, I mean, look at Cal. They were, I mean, I remember when they had Aaron Rodgers as their quarterback, cause they pulled that just wild upset in 2003. And then in 2004, one of the craziest games I've ever been to was, a number 7 Cal heading into a number 1 USC. Both were undefeated. That was the first time game day had ever gone to USC. I mean, the hype was off the charts. But still, both, I mean, USC at that was actually the first time USC came close to selling out the Coliseum for a non-rivalry, non-UCLA, non-Notre Dame game where like half the stadium is the other fan base. But that was the first time they ever passed 90,000 fans since they played Oklahoma in the 70s. I mean, it had just been that long before the USC had woken up, and it took that kind of a competition. And still, I mean, both programs, I mean, Cal, if you even look at the numbers back then, they weren't – they had a couple of games where they nearly sold out the Memorial Coliseum, but – or probably the Memorial Stadium, but they couldn't quite get there. So it's interesting what it takes out there. Hey, Jason, I know you wanted to add to something to this, and then Juwan, I'd love to hear from you as well.
Well, I was going to you were talking about the culture at USC, and I think over the last sort of few years, I have a question for JD because he's, you know, a TCU guy and, you know, follows Texas football pretty hard and now is doing, I think he said, grad school at Texas. So I kind of have a question and sort of a rant. I'm going to take a hard right turn in this case.
Go for it.
So something that drives me nuts, and I know this is going to be an unpopular opinion with Texas fans, but I get so tired and I can't be off here. I can't be way off when I think that TCU and A&M and Texas Tech fans, they've got to feel the same way, where you always hear about, oh, well, Texas is back. I get so tired of hearing that because go back and look into their history. Like, where exactly, per se, are they back from? They've had three undefeated
Amen, brother.
In their history, and outside of the Mack Brown years and a couple of other seasons sprinkled in here and there, they have been largely mediocre for the majority of that university's existence. So when ESPN makes them darlings and puts them number six in the preseason poll, it's like, oh, Texas is back. Where are they back from? They've had like one good stretch where they were really dominant under Mack Brown. I don't get it. They're not a blue blood program. It drives me nuts that people think they are. And it's not like, you know, something personal, but does that drive TCU fans and Texas A&M fans and just Texas people in general nuts who aren't big fans of Texas?
I wouldn't say it drives us nuts. I think we more than anything laugh about it because especially in the most recent decade, we've seen a lot of, for lack of a better word, ineptitude from the University of Texas when it comes to the amount of resources they have, the amount of willingness, the amount of administrative support, amount of fan support, amount of just everything with their capabilities, and then to consistently not come up with a big win. Like one of the fun stats that I saw earlier was in this past decade, the University of Texas has had one season where they had 10 wins or more. Oklahoma State has had 7 in that same time frame. So you want to talk about, how we feel about it for the non-Texas fans. I think the general sentiment that I've gotten from across the state is the kind of like when Lucy would pull the football for Charlie Brown, is the same exact idea of like, Texas is back. They finally have it figured out. And nope, lost to Kansas. Oh, nope. Had it way too close for comfort. Weren't able to get into the championship game again. Oh, going off an 8-4. Oh, gone off to a losing season. Oh, there's a stripper monkey now involved. It's that way every single year. And I think it's now at a point where it's not annoyance. It's just a perverse delight, if that makes any kind of sense.
You know, JD, I have to echo this. There was one of the funnier kind of satire posts that showed up on RCFB earlier this week, actually just a day ago, was a self-reflective, self-conscious, ability to laugh at himself Texas fan who has a very complicated Urashiba Kazu Koto. So I'm sure that has something to do with anime or something. But anyway, let's end this useless pandering and cut straight to the chase. Since the Texas swim program has been much more successful than the Texas football program, with 22 national championships in swim and 99 conference titles and no monkey shenanigans, why doesn't Texas just cut the football program and turn DKR into one giant swimming pool? I'm sure it will take a bit of water, but the tears of Texas fans after every loss in the SEC should be more than enough to fill up DKR. Some people were questioning whether he was a Texas fan, but I think it was just that's kind of cuts to what we were just talking about. Have they quite been able to? What are they coming back to, and when will it ever happen? But that is an open question.
I meant to ask you guys when we started, did you happen to catch the headlines of the Texas offensive lineman that had the interview? And he told the interviewer he doesn't feel like Texas is very good because the players are worried about NIL, alcohol, and women instead of being good at football. And then I have a couple things to add in about USC. I just wanted to see if you guys had seen that headline earlier.
Yes, I did actually see that, and the University of Texas actually revoked that player's speaking privileges for the media. Sark and the SID over there, over at the University of Texas, ended up pulling his access, pretty much told him, like, that's in-house conversation. You're not supposed to say that to media, which, before I get into a long rant on, you know, constricting players from being able to speak freely to media and give interesting press bites like that, it's definitely, I think, a good thing to hear that type of criticism. And if you have that in-house and you're not addressing that, something needs to be stated out loud. And for that type of player to come out and be willing to say that, especially if it was a player that was originally vetted enough, because again, in order for any player to speak to media, they got to go through a long vetting process, a lot of media coaching. For him to go through all that and then still state that, it says a lot about the culture at that program. And for me, I'm very curious to see how in year two, Steve Sarkisian ends up addressing that and trying to change that culture and what exactly that's going to look like as we actually start to play games. I think that's going to be very fascinating. And I definitely think he's going to be one of those guys, if he can't turn something around. I mean, this is a guy, if he loses again to Kansas, that's going to be a guy who's not going to make it to a year three deal. But with the amount of money that's there, the amount of pressure that's there, I'm very curious to see what his response to this season is going to be.
Well, and two, that, like, Texas has the same kind of problem that a school like Auburn has, you know, because if you ask me the question, who's in charge of the football program at Georgia, you know, everyone here is going to say Kirby Smart.
Yes.
Or everyone would say Dabo Sweeney or
yes.
Nick Saban. Whereas if you asked who's in charge of the football program at Texas or Auburn, you might get seven different answers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the only difference is Auburn actually gets it done from time to time, unlike Texas has over the past few years.
Hey, listen, the only reason that they haven't gotten it done is because they haven't found the right church to give $200,000 to just yet.
Well, I was going to add this earlier whenever Bobby was talking about USC, because that's something I'm really passionate about. And I feel like these two programs, Texas and USC, kind of go hand in hand, because just in my recollection over the past few years where I've been watching college football, I'm 30 now, and even playing high school football, that's probably my most memorable national championship game besides the 2002 Ohio State versus Miami. Now, excuse me. Now with USC, I think just looking back at those times, USC, if name, image, and likeness was around back then, I'm not sure there'd be a team that would have generated more money or more hype or more success than USC. Like when you take a look back at it, they had two Heisman winners in the same backfield. I don't think we'll ever see that type of thing again, not to mention the type of defense those guys had. I was just watching the Trojan War documentary again because I love going back and looking at old football history. And I just remember myself being a 15-year-old looking at Reggie Bush. And as a football player, that's all I wanted to be growing up as a kid, was Reggie Bush, just the highlight plays that he made. And who USC was at that time, they just looked cool. And I'm a kid from the South. And I remember as myself going into the recruiting process and my coach asking me, what schools do you think you want to go to? USC was like top three, what I told him. But I was like, I want to be a Trojan. They had just went on this amazing run with Carson Palmer. They were switching over Matt Leinart and all those guys. And I feel like if they would have just kept that going, or got in the right coach, and if they didn't get all those penalties from Reggie Bush losing his Heisman and all that things going, we could be talking about a different USC Trojan team right now.
Well, it's certainly, I know, same years you had guys like Snoop on the sideline. I still remember that moment where Lendale White ran in a touchdown and just handed the ball to Snoop, and Snoop Dogg like looked at the camera because he had told him in an interview earlier in the game, like, watch, someone's going to hand me the ball. And he just looked at the camera and said, told you, and just, like, ran off, which was – that was the era of watching college football in those heyday of USC. Adam, what did you want to add to this?
Yeah. So as a native Californian and now living in the South, Jason, you like this. I've been living in Alabama for a couple years now, loving it. Great place, awesome people. You know, been around the South a little bit, but you know, as a football coach and a college football coach too, talking with, you know, a bunch of coaches, some older guys, really, they always kind of, you know, not shit talk the West Coast as far as players and what kind of kids you get out of there. But it's funny whenever I bring up, well, you know, who was the best tight end for Georgia, you know, kid from California, you know, who has Alabama had in the backfield the past couple of years, and Bryce Young, and then, you know, Najee Harris. Those are two California kids. And, you know, I think it's just funny how from the old days, it used to be, you know, kids stayed in a regional area. They wanted to play at that school, like, you know, Juwan was saying, you know, hey, I wanted to go to USC, you know, and that's not close to home. But now it's, you know, kids don't care to stay at that school that they might have grown up watching every Saturday that's on local television. You know, now you can access any team in the country and watch those games. So the fandom has grown, and I think that's been a good thing for the sport. But
oh, absolutely, I think you're right, Adam. I think it's definitely just grown the game. If USD starts rolling again, or you know, let's say Oregon, or you know, any team, let's say Minnesota suddenly becomes a powerhouse, you'll get people who suddenly want to go there because that's also their best ticket to potentially going to the NFL.
Exactly.
But if it's exciting and fun, like what Pete Carroll made it seem like, Nick Saban makes it look like a factory, which isn't a bad thing. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's a different approach. You'll get people that want to do these things. Hey, Ray, you want to join us? So we'd love to hear from you. Unmute yourself.
Hey, what's going on, man?
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. So I've got 2 points that I kind of, one was stringing off. I think it was Adam was the last speaker. That's a good point about guys not really staying regionally. But then you see a lot of the guys that don't have immediate success kind of transfer and get homesick. I mean, you know, like we, you know, I'm 25, you know, someone else admitted they're 30, you know, growing up a little bit, but you see like these 18, 19 year old kids that like, hey, I was promised a starting spot in your recruiting pitch. I thought I was going to go for 1,000 yards this year or whatever. You kind of see them revert on a lot of that. So that'll be interesting if as USC starts to draw in a lot of these big transfers that they have, like even Williams from OU and whatnot. I don't know where he's from off the top of my head. But I saw in ESPN's FPI, they were projected at 8-4. I see their 4 losses probably as Notre Dame, Utah. I want to say Oregon State because it's in Corvallis, and then maybe UCLA.
Corvallis. West Coast. West Coast, sorry.
We get it. Don't worry.
Yeah, I was just curious if anyone had any other thoughts on what their 4th, 5th, and maybe even 6th losses would be.
Add Utah in there, definitely, I think. Me personally.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned that. I think it's always going to be unpredictable with a new coach. So this first season could be anything. I wouldn't be surprised if we get a shocker at a team you just don't expect. I mean, I fully expect USC to roll through the non – well, I mean, the initial – Notre Dame's technically non-conference, as we've kind of talked about with their scheduling. But, I mean, I expect them to roll through Rice. Now, Stanford's going to be the immediate test. Stanford, even when they're not great, has been – a problem for USC over the years, ever since, I think, you know, ever since Harbaugh was at Stanford in that crazy 2007 game. That is a legendary moment in a legendary season. So that's game 2. For whatever reason, they keep having this tradition of playing, because technically people don't really think about this. USC's biggest rivals are UCLA and Notre Dame, but they've always also been rivals with Stanford and Cal. USC fans will always call the game at the Bay Area the Weekender, and I'm sure some of their fans say the same thing. The late, great ESPN college football writer Beano Cook put it best years ago. I think it was 2002 when I read the article. But he said, Cal and Stanford are rivals, but they both hate USC. And that goes back to the 19-teens, as crazy as that sounds, because before the 20s, before USC got to be like a powerhouse in the West Coast, they were the powerhouses. And then, you know, just like Los Angeles being the younger city to San Francisco, it's suddenly, you know, vapid, you know, all the cliche things you'd say about, you know, people from Los Angeles, they were in fashion 100 years ago, all right? So they hated it, and that's why that's a rivalry. But anyway, Rice, I'm pretty sure USC will probably still have just the firepower to beat them. Stanford, honestly, could be their first loss because it's just Stanford, and it's at Stanford. Fresno State could, I don't know, you know, you're always going to get your – Oh, go ahead.
Now, Fresno, they kept Jake Haener, right?
I don't remember.
If they kept him, and you know, it's week three, so if Riley doesn't have his defense strung together like he really wants it, that could be an upset alert. I'd love to see what the what Vegas sets the line at there come mid September.
Don't forget, Tedford's back.
Exactly, and I think with just the fact is, you know. We were talking about Reggie Bush earlier. I mean, the craziest game he ever had was against Fresno State in 2005. And people don't remember, Fresno State almost took out USC, but for Reggie Bush. That was one of the wildest games I've ever seen. And if you can go back and see a game that you might not have heard of or you know, you like to watch classic games, watch the 2005 USC-Fresno State game. It is at USC. Fresno State leaves it all on the field. I mean, that was probably the peak of Pat Hill as a head coach, and he's the one who made Fresno State quite serious over the years. And that's why I think Fresno State still has an amiable relationship with him, even though he was fired. He's still close to the program. But that was like watching the first Rocky movie happen in a football game, where, sure, Rocky doesn't quite win at – spoiler alert – doesn't win at the end. Of Rocky, but holy cow, you go, he just really took the champ to the ropes. Go back and watch that game, because it is, at the end, it is literally watching Reggie Bush look like someone's got a PlayStation controller controlling him, because humans don't move like that to put USC back in that game. But so that moment, I can tell you, Fresno State, anytime they get a chance to play in the Coliseum or in the Rose Bowl against UCLA, they're going to give it all it's going to be. So that could be an upset. Who knows? You know, as someone pointed out, this last Easter was the one-year anniversary since we had that monstrosity that Lincoln Riley shared in his version of brisket, so dry that the Sahara, you know, dried up looking at it. But, you know, my favorite reaction to that anniversary was, never post your meat on the internet. Nothing good can come from that, no matter how you interpret that particular thing. JD, do you want to add anything to this? We're going to probably, by the way, and I apologize, we try to keep these to an hour. We're going to probably start wrapping up pretty soon here. JD, what do you want to add anything to our – by the way, we're pretty sure, because this is a mystery to us. We don't necessarily, you know, as a Twitter account, go after people in a way that we consider to be – outrageous, and for some reason Lincoln Riley just blocked us out of the blue after he joined USC.
What?
We don't know where that even came from. We're
yes.
He keeps sharing his meat. Yes.
Yes, that is literally what it was.
The meat tweet. That's the only thing we can come up. And it's not like we were the only ones who pointed out how ridiculous that was. But JD.
Well, apparently the man has a long history of blocking folks who in any way, shape, or form have any type of criticism to say. I know there's a couple other coaches who have worked off of that MO before. I think overall, when it comes to what we're going to look at for the USC season for this upcoming season, I would love to speak into existence just for absolute hilarity. You know, they go on the road to Utah. And then that's going to be a tough game no matter how they play it, with the elevation, with the toughness of Kyle Whittingham's teams. Then they get a bye week afterwards. My goodness, if I wouldn't be laughing hysterically if they go on the road again on the 29th and then just absolutely face plant in front of the Arizona Wildcats in Tucson. I think that would be the funniest loss that USC could possibly pull off for this upcoming year. And just for the hilarity, I'm going to try to speak that into existence.
I love it. And again, my favorite comment on the old Lincoln Riley brisket post was, I can't believe Lincoln did that to his pair of boots. That armadillo had a family. But on that note, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. It's been about an hour. We love talking to all of you. We'll be back here next Tuesday. We're going to have an interview guest for a change. We've been meaning to do that, but with the offseason, we even get distracted. But it's going to be fun. We're going to have some pre-draft talk with an expert. It should be an enjoyable conversation. We'll probably promote it a little bit more than right on the night of than we typically do. But I just wanted to thank all of you on behalf of JD and I. Thanks for joining RCFB Talk 28. We hope you have a great week, and feel free to join us next Tuesday. Have a great night, everyone.
Thank you all.